Today on Speaking Out of Place, we chat with Camilla Hawthorne about her recently edited collection, The Black Geographic, Praxis, Resistance, Futurity, and its relation to her prior monograph, Contesting Race and Citizenship, Youth Politics in the Black Mediterranean. She explains and elaborates on how Blackness is not singular, but taking place in imaginative and resistant ways that span many different political terrains, whether it be citizenship, the city, the imagining of futures after environmental collapse, and diverse linguistic, cultural, and musical affiliations across diasporic communities.
Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content.
I'd like you to talk about this new edited anthology that you did called Black Geographic and put it into conversation with your monograph, which is Contesting Race and Citizenship, Youth Politics in the Black Mediterranean. How do you see those two things working together and opening up a very interesting set of questions?
Yeah. First, thanks for having me here. The Black Geographic book, we're so excited that it's finally out in the world because it really was a labor of love that emerged out of a symposium that Jovan Scott Lewis and I, along with some other comrades at UC Berkeley, organized in the fall of 2017, actually in the midst of those devastating wildfires in California. So we were all wearing masks, going to this conference. And then after that, we had tried to pull together an edited volume based on that symposium. And then it became a bit of a victim of the pandemic, like so much academic publishing with a shortage of reviewers. And so it took many years for it to finally come out into the world. And so it's interesting because the relevance of that symposium and the volume in 2017, 2018, and its relevance now, it's quite different. And so I'm going to try to answer both of your questions by talking a little bit about my relation to the field of Black geographies. So one of the things that we try to emphasize in the edited volume is that Black geographics thought is not new. If we look at the history of the Black radical tradition and practices of Black spacemaking, Black geographic thought, Black life is inherently geographic. But it's only relatively recently, right, in the past decade or so, maybe 20 years, that we've begun to see the kind of emergence of a consolidated and recognized field of study that is Black geographies, right, that is moving in the direction of institutionalization. Before, we can look to a long genealogy of thinkers across the Black diaspora who have been doing spatial theory, but that wasn't always recognized within the disciplinary boundaries of geography as spatial theory, as geography. This was something that was really shocking to me when I started my PhD in geography at Berkeley in 2012. I came from a very interdisciplinary background. My undergraduate degree was partially in Africana studies. And so I came to geography thinking, okay, I don't have a degree in geography, but I have a general understanding of how to think about space and place because my background is in thinking about diaspora, right? So reading Paul Gilroy, reading Sylvia Winter, reading C.L.R. James, right? Theories of the Black diaspora for our spatial theories. And then notice this kind of disjuncture between what I understood as geographical thought, the geographical processes that I wanted to study, which were Black practices of space making, place making, identity formation in relation to space. And then what I was being presented as what geographers do in the kind of pro seminars that you take in grad school, where if we read work by Black scholars, and we did read some, it was primarily Stuart Hall, maybe a little bit of Du Bois, but really not that much. And there was a sense that we had to really, especially of the grad students in my cohort, we really had to fight to have questions of race and coloniality be centered in the way that we were learning about geography rather than as these peripheral add-ons to the work that we do. A lot of the first few years of my time in grad school was really trying to carve out space in the curriculum, in the kind of genealogies that I was drawing on for an understanding of geography that really centered Blackness, Black practices of space making, diasporic thinking. And I found very quickly that I wasn't alone. I was lucky that I came in with a cohort of really brilliant scholars who were also trying to do this. And so we were forming our own reading groups and taking classes in other departments and working closely with the sympathetic faculty in our department. But then beyond that, there were these pockets of scholars all over the country, and really all over the world, who had also been really pushing for the centrality of Blackness in the field of geography, right? That Blackness is really central to how these foundational categories of race and space and capital play out right through the sort of global history of racial capitalism, but also that there's this long tradition of Black spatial theory that has been neglected or marginalized as not sufficiently geographic. So I was really fortunate that through this searching, I was able to link up with people who had been thinking about these things for much longer than I have, right? There's generations of folks who are now being recognized as foundational geographic thinkers, people like Clyde Woods, or Bobby Wilson, or Ruth Wilson Gilmore, or Catherine McKittrick, and then even younger generations of scholars, people like Latoya Eaves, who started the Black Geography Specialty Group of the American Association of Geographers. So anyway, all of that is to say that with this symposium in 2017, when Jovan Scott Lewis joined Berkeley's geography department, we decided that we wanted to convene a gathering of scholars who were doing this work to really talk about where the field has come and where it's going, and to bring that together then in this book. So when we organized the symposium, Black Geographies was really still coming onto the stage in a really powerful way as a field. The specialty group was a couple of years old. We were just beginning to see in the field of geography calls for faculty positions in Black geographies, right? Now the field is much more established. And so the volume has, we now see it as an attempt to take stock of what work has been done, but also what new potential new avenues for research are. And so this is now the connection to the work that I'm doing. One of the things that Black Geographies has offered for me that's really useful beyond a recognition of the inherent spatiality of Black life is also this attention to geographical specificity when we talk about Blackness, because there's a lot of literature that often treats Blackness as a sort of univocal subjectivity, as a universal condition that's tied to what Michelle Wright refers to as the middle passage epistemology, right? This kind of spatio-temporal framework for understanding Blackness that starts with sort of an origin point on the African continent, a traumatic dispersal across the Atlantic through the transatlantic slave trade, and then the creation of sort of new ways of diasporic being in North America. And when I started doing my research, what I found was that there are all of these ways that Black life in the Mediterranean and in Southern Europe and in Italy specifically didn't totally map onto that sort of very neat linear story of Blackness, where people have very different kinds of political, intergenerational, genealogical relations to the history of the transatlantic slave trade, where stories of colonialism and anti-colonial resistance and post-colonial subjectivity are very intimately connected to how they come to understand their Blackness, as well as histories of migration and intergenerational experiences of border violence. And so a Black geographic perspective for me was really helpful in trying to clarify how we can simultaneously understand Blackness as a global project that is anti-national, that transcends borders, but that also takes on really specific meanings and practices in different places, such that we can't look to one region as having a more authentic expression of Blackness. And so one of the things that we also really tried to push for in the Black geographic volume was for engagements with Black geographies that are looking just beyond the framework of North America. So we have a chapter that thinks about the construction and contestation of Blackness in the Sahel, contributors who are thinking about places like Brazil, and also folks who are thinking about those moments where Black and Indigenous geographies meet.
I think also resisting the essentialization of Blackness is something that was were one moment in the anthology Black Geographic that was really striking when one of the contributors, Sharita Town, uses Black not as an adjective, but as a verb. She talks about Blacking. One of the themes that has emerged over this podcast series in general, particularly in conversations with people who work at the intersection of academia and activism, is how methodologically to approach academic engagements with activist communities of struggle, dispossessed communities that are being studied in ways that refuse the reproduction of relationships of surveillance and extractivism that characterize carcerality, coloniality, capitalism as a whole. And so can you talk a bit about what it might mean to Black geography as a verb in ways that resist dominant geographies of reason and identity?
Yeah, thank you so much. I was actually going back to recently, I gave a talk over Zoom for a collective in Italy. It was a series of keyword lectures, and my keyword was Blackness or Nerezza in the Italian context. And so I use that as an opportunity to go back to our introduction in the Black Geographic to remind myself of the thinking that Jovan and I had done about both the geography of Blackness and the Blackness of geography. And one of the things that we write in that introduction is that the problem isn't that geography has ignored Black people until now. In fact, quite the opposite, right? And we know from the history of sociology, the history of anthropology, and so many disciplines, that it's not as though these disciplines ignored people of color. And in fact, they were overly preoccupied with people of color for the purpose of surveillance, of colonial mapping, for extraction, for domination. Geography has a similar kind of relationship to Blackness as well, where the dominant way in which geography related to Blackness was through the kind of mapping. So what actually Clyde Woods, the late great geographer Clyde Woods, has this wonderful essay where he asks, have we become little more than academic coroners, where simply what we're doing is cataloging dead or dying communities? That there's a particular way in which geography has approached the question of Blackness and spatiality through a deficit lens, where Black people are aspatial, right? They do not have a spatiality because they are endlessly uprooted, endlessly mobile, or by contrast, they are locked into space, right? They are locked into degraded, dying spaces. And what both of those things do is produce a particular view of geography that is centered on death, dying, lack, and absence, right? There is no spatiality. There is no futurity. It's simply a cataloging of violence inflicted on communities. And so
almost like a necrogeography, you could say.
Exactly. And Catherine McKittrick has written about this extensively in her work, and particularly in her most recent book, Dear Science, where she says that there's a particular fixation, not only in geography, but more broadly in the way that academics talk about Blackness, which is a sort of fixation on the Black body as a site of violation. Even in well-intentioned efforts to document the workings of racism, there is this reproduction of Blackness as always in a state of decay and disrepair. Robin D.G. Kelly has written about this as well in a piece that I often cite, Black Study, Black Struggle, where he says that this fixation on a violated and dying Black body ignores the fact that Blackness has always exceeded suffering and violation, and that Blackness is also tied to these radical practices of world making, these radical practices of imagination that have resisted the most horrific forms of oppression. And so when I teach Black geographies to my students, I always try to remind them that a Black geographic approach is not just about cataloging all the ways that Black communities have been violated through the spatial enactment of racial violence, but it's also about uplifting those radical practices of Black spacemaking, alternative forms of mapping, forms of community survival and thriving that offer us new ways of viewing the world.
I was thinking as you were speaking of a story I tell in the book, Speaking Out of Place, of St. Clair Drake's Black Metropolis, when one of the predominant tropes was blight, urban blight. And every time he mentions that word in his book, he puts it in scare quotes. So it's a kind of resistance with, and I think he was an assistant professor at that point, or maybe even a graduate student when he wrote this. So I thought that was a great example how St. Clair Drake in that monumental book calls out the pathologizing, but puts it under erasure, distancing himself, calling out the field of urban studies as being complicit in creating and perpetuating this mapping of Black geography. And another text from your collection is Anna Brand's essay on Katrina, and the way in which there's this dominant notion of how to rebuild New Orleans at this moment. It made me think of exactly the same thing happened in 1906 with the San Francisco earthquake, mm-hmm. when San Francisco decided they were going to completely relocate Chinese and create this ghetto someplace apart and create a rather different way of mapping Asia onto the Pacific rim there. Could you talk a little bit about these ways in which you reimagine space, like in the Katrina? I love the example she gave of the attention to physicality, like tables and doors and all these things that would escape the logic of a rebuilding according to a capitalist project, creating a financial zone rather than a living zone. Could you talk a little bit about that? And then maybe I do want to get to your book on Italy, because we find similar kinds of ways of reworking standard notions of occupying space.
Yeah, there's a long tradition in this field of Black geographies of thinking about critical human geography. There's a strong current of urban geography within that field and Black geographies as well. So thinking about questions of Blackness and the production of urban space, because the city is such a powerful site through which to think about contestations over space, racial capitalism, questions of belonging and the production of identities. So there's some Anna Brand's work is one example of that. I'm also thinking about Corbin's chapter on the Oakland Development Plan, where Corbin is looking at these graphics that were produced for this urban redevelopment plan for the city and actually thinking even at the minute level of the rendered graphics of city dwellers in this community that if you've been to Oakland, that's a predominantly Black and Brown community. And then we see this sort of shiny redeveloped vision in which, you know, most of the figures who are meant to represent the occupants are now white. I'm also reminded of another colleague, Brandy Summers, who's not in the book, but who is an interlocutor collaborator also at UC Berkeley, who's talked about about urban aesthetics and Black aesthetic emplacement and thinking about the aesthetics of gentrification, right? Exposed brick or these sterile, pure white interiors, right? So also thinking about the aesthetic practices through which race is materially enacted. And in fact, I think that's one of the really interesting methodological contributions of Black geographic scholarship and something that Jovan and I write about a lot, which is really attentive to this interplay of material processes, right? What I often refer to as like the big clanking gears of racial capitalism, right? There's a really an effort to really hold on to a very strong political economic critique that's grounded in the Black radical tradition, but also thinking about these sort of everyday poetic processes, right? The things that we may not, you know, that for a long time, maybe geographers dismissed as not the real meat of the material processes, but looking at things like aesthetic politics and aesthetic representations. Another colleague, Kylie Heights, who looks at street art as a site through which to understand contestations over urban space. And again, those are the alternative geographies, right? The alternative ways of knowing, things that help us look past what McKittrick calls transparent space to really look at all of the different ways in which people craft space and engage in contestations over space in cities.
You spoke of street signs and aesthetics, another important site in Black geographic for imagining worlds organized differently is literature, futuristic literature, in which the very categories through which we so often take for granted the organization of space, categories such as property, the nation state, are fundamentally called into question. Here I'm also reminded of critical geographer Stuart Eldon's comments about the relationship between territory and terror, that territory, far from being a neutral category or way of thinking about the organization of space, is actually, in one of its possible etymologies, fundamentally related to the same root as the word for terror, which speaks to the relationship between violence and law in creating these very ideas of space that we have in the first place. And so can you talk a bit about how Black geographies, not only through abstract theorizations, but also poetic and literary imaginations, as well as everyday on-the-ground practices, produces ways of imagining all of these categories through which our spatial relationships are organized, so often taken for granted, nation-state property in ways that not only obscure the background conditions of anti-Blackness, anti-Indigenous violence, anti-Muslim violence that have been central in their production, but also then treat as a terra nullius, the very different forms and ways of relating to land that continue to inhere in Black and Indigenous ways of being.
Yeah, thank you. I think what's key is that the archive of sort of Black geographic thought is so vast, right? And it does, and it includes literature and it includes poetry. I especially appreciate your sort of referencing of the speculative, at least speaking for me personally, but I know many of my colleagues in the field, speculative fiction is such an important political and theoretical touchstone for all of us. So when I did an undergraduate senior seminar on abolition geographies, and for the first week of that seminar, I have my students read speculative fiction. And they often come in thinking that in week one, they're going to start by reading reports on police violence and racial disparities in policing. And no, in the first week, I have them read Ursula Le Guin's The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, followed by N.K. Jemisin's response to that story, which is The Ones Who Stay and Fight, along with an essay by Adrienne Marie Brown on speculative fiction. And part of what I explained to them is that to do this work, we are constantly faced in our scholarship, but even in our sort of our lives as activists and community organizers with this sort of neoliberal, there is no alternative, so just be pragmatic and focus on small goals framing of what it means to act in the world. I know that all of us who have done abolitionist organizing have been told at some point, that's unrealistic, be pragmatic, what can we actually accomplish in the here and now? And there's something so, I think, tragic, but also very deliberate about this pruning of our radical imagination that happens every day in the world, right? To say, no, it's not possible. Be realistic. And so I tell students that we're starting with speculative fiction because my goal is to open up their radical imagination, right? What happens if we start by opening up radical imagination, understand imagination as a political act, right? Again, drawing on Robin D.G. Kelly, Freedom Dreaming, and writing so much other work on the politics of imagination. Because speculative fiction is a tool for politics, I think, in two ways. One, and I'm a longtime science fiction fan, like I grew up watching Star Trek with my dad, still one of my favorite socialist space utopias.
Okay, so we've outed you as a Trekkie on this show.
It's not a secret. It's not a secret at all. I tell my students that on the one hand, what good speculative fiction does is it takes our world and it renders it slightly unfamiliar so that the things that we take for granted come into sharp focus in a way that they didn't before. We watch Star Trek, for example, and we suddenly see a world where there is no currency within the Federation. And all of a sudden we have to think about money and why it is that we actually have money in the first place in our world. And then the other thing is that it gives us tools to begin imagining what it might be like to construct another world. So going back to the example of Le Guin and Jemisin, I think both of those stories are doing those things. The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, not to spoil it for folks who haven't heard it, but it's about this beautiful utopian society. And then you find that the functioning of the society depends on the suffering of one child who is kept in a cage. And if she is freed, the society collapses. And so it's supposed to get us to think about all of the exploitation and suffering upon which our world depends that we don't think about and that we choose to ignore so that we can go about enjoying all of our commodities and our cars and our gas and our oil and all of that stuff. And N.K. Jemisin's The Ones Who Stay and Fight takes that premise and then flips it and says, what actually are the conditions of possibility to create a society in which it is regarded as completely unacceptable that some people should be allowed to suffer? And she plays this out. And there are moments when it's disturbing and it's troubling. And I've had really complicated conversations with my students about it. But she is trying to do that speculative act of world building to say, what does it actually take to create that world? And so that's just a long way of saying that I think there's a reason why this kind of fiction and speculative fiction is such an important touchstone for so many of us in Black geographies, because it is this tool for thinking about our world in new ways and then also trying to imagine alternative modes of world building.
We could just detour this entire conversation into sci-fi, because I was thinking as you were speaking about Omelas that when I teach the text, I always ask my students, among other things, how do we know the world would fall apart if the kid was let out of the basement? We don't know. And so much of the text is about education in its worst sense, right? Because as the children who hear the story initially think this is really terrible, and then they gradually start getting sucked into subscribing to this notion. And I was also thinking about another text of hers, which is more spatial, is the word for world is forest. But I was very interested in exactly the force of the imagination coming up against the political realities of neoliberalism, of capitalism, etc. And the essay that talks about Senegal in the 19th century is really interesting. But also, again, I would really like you to talk about your work in Italy, because you talk about the same kinds of things, right? To negotiate the space of citizenship versus migrant, to disabuse Italy of its notion that it never had Black people until, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So how do you break through these prefabricated and very obdurate structures with refiguring space, refiguring political space?
So actually going back to Aziza's question about doing scholarship that's in dialogue with activist communities, that has been collective work. And my book is certainly not the first to do that, and it certainly won't be the last. And in fact, something that I often say is that scholars who are studying Black Italy, we are basically playing catch up to the activists and the artists who have been doing this theorizing in different spaces for much longer. Some of the most cutting edge thinking and work and engagements around rethinking questions of race in the Italian peninsula, around reckoning with Italian colonial legacies, have really come from filmmakers and novelists and artists. And there's a reason why, you know, my work is ethnographic, but there's a reason why so much of the work in this sort of emerging field of Black Italian studies is scholars reading the work of novelists, because the novelists are actually the ones who are doing the work of theorizing. And so similarly, when I was carrying out this project, I wanted, to the extent that I could, to engage in theorizing in a way that was deeply collaborative. There is a way that ethnographic research can be extraordinarily extractive, where you, the ethnographer, go into a community, you suck the raw material out of the people you're talking to, they give you raw data, and then you turn that into theoretical juice. So they give you raw data, and then you do the analysis and turn it into theory. And that's not what I wanted to do, because all of my comrades in Italy are more sophisticated, nuanced political thinkers than I am. So how could we learn together and talk across our experiences in order to arrive at some kind of shared understandings of Italian Blackness in a diasporic context? For me, that was really the goal of the research that I was doing, to think about my own positionality as someone who is an Italian citizen. My mom is from Northern Italy, but my father is African American. I was born and raised in California, but I have Italian citizenship thanks to the same racist, descent-based citizenship framework that denies citizenship to so many of my comrades. And so often what started out as interviews turned into conversations where we were thinking about the connections, but also the disjunctures between our experiences of Blackness, and using that to think through how questions of borders and citizenship shape the lived experience and the political mobilization of Blackness in different contexts. Another example of this for me was the fact that, and I write about this in the book, I came into this project not wanting to talk about citizenship at all, because my own kind of theoretical training was taught me to be very skeptical of citizenship as a sort of tool of liberal accommodationism, as a tool of assimilation, as a tool of the racial capitalist state, and therefore to turn up my nose at any kind of politics that was oriented on citizenship as a goal. And that was very cocky of me, right? Then I actually started having these incredible conversations with activists who were working on questions of citizenship, and were doing so with a profound and deep awareness of the contradictions of that work, about the limitations of that work. And so talking to them about both what citizenship could potentially enable, but also what it foreclosed, and these difficult but necessary compromises and shifting tactics and alliances taught me so much about citizenship. And in a way, obviously, the book is deeply indebted to the kind of theorization on the ground that happens in community organizing spaces and at demonstrations and in the really hard conversations that happen in political movements.
So what precisely then do you think the role of the academic is in that kind of context? You talking about the debates on citizenship, and in your book, you pointed to Giorgio Agamben's intervention, again, very critical of citizenship from his place of possessing citizenship himself, and yet recommending against those who were deprived of it from seeking to expand the terms of citizenship so that they could also be included in it without talking about giving up his own citizenship himself. And so what is the role of the academic departing from that kind of position of privilege that Agamben occupies to instead think about how we might engage critically with concepts of citizenship from an abolitionist perspective that doesn't discount the longings and the desires and the dire necessities of those who are excluded from those structures of power, but think about how some of their violences might be mitigated in the interim while working towards their abolition in the long term?
Yeah, this is something that I actually think about a lot as someone who is an academic and also involved in various movement spaces, right? Sort of what is my role as an academic? And is that role actually necessary? I think about this a lot and I've lost a ton of sleep over it. And it's something that's it's constantly evolving for me. But I think I see a few things. One is that academic knowledge production is not the only mode of knowledge production. It's one of many different forms of producing and sharing knowledge about the world. And I think part of what we do as academics is there's a certain level of, let's say, abstraction and generalization where we're taking on the ground struggles and attempting to situate them more broadly in the context of longer genealogies of struggle, longer genealogies of theory, to think about how particular movements and strategies translate across geographical contexts. And in saying that, it also is evident that one does not necessarily have to be a professor or hold the PhD to produce that kind of knowledge either. So I think it's interesting what happens when we begin to delink the degree, the profession from and the notion of knowledge production, and actually understand that all of these things can be recombined in different ways, right? One can produce critical knowledge about the world without being an academic. One does not have to be an academic to do that kind of that labor of theory or sort of the construction of genealogies. And just the other day, I was teaching selections from Gramsci's Prison Notebooks to my undergrads, where he says that philosophy, all men and women are philosophers, and that the process of philosophy is not just restricted to those people who occupy a particular class position or a particular profession, but that the work and the collective work is to take that already ongoing activity and render it critical and able to then challenge existing power structures. And then, of course, there's also the role that we have as educators as well. And that's one that has become, that is very important to me, both in terms of the work that I do as an educator at UC Santa Cruz, but also the ongoing pedagogical work that I do in Italy as someone who is able to, who has had access to historical archives, who is able to read in both Italian and English. I often ask to lead workshops or seminars, not only for other academics or students, but also for community groups, again, helping to connect people to political genealogies and readings and resources that help to contextualize these emerging struggles in Italy within a kind of wider context of theorization. Again, because of the sort of power dynamics that shape academic knowledge production, there is no Black studies in Italy. There is no kind of there are no Black studies departments really in Europe outside of the UK, right? It's a very marginalized field. And so there are people who are doing the work of Black studies and post-colonial studies, but it's only in the last couple of years that critical mass of this work has started to get translated into Italian. And in a way, I see myself as also a bit of a broker and just trying to help people figure out how to put together these intellectual genealogies in ways that can be adequate for struggle. But it's also always a dialogical process, right? Because I'm not able to do the work that I do without really trying to hold myself accountable to my comrades and the movements that I'm a part of in Italy.
I want to say that the suspicion of the politics of recognition, I think begs us to decide who we are suspicious of being recognized by versus the people that we might rather be recognized by, right? In other words, it's not always the state that we have to petition. It might be that civil society is more important for us to be recognized by in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of this horrible way in which Palestinians in the Israeli popular imagination are absolutely dehumanized. But recently, there are these demonstrations in Tel Aviv. There's a point in which, even with probably the most horrific signings on by the Israeli Jewish population of, yeah, we're not bombing enough more quickly, there's a kind of crack in that. There's a kind of opening that I think is interesting. Yeah. And I'd like for us to talk about this that exceeds the power of the state to determine what could be recognized as what. And so if you could talk a little bit about race in that regard. And also, one interesting thing you say in your book, well, among the many interesting things you say in your book, you talk about, is citizenship a proxy for the human? Which I thought was so profound. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because that's what struck me again when I was thinking about Gaza and the human and, and the not human, right?
Yeah. And actually, just also holding on to the question of Gaza and just tying that back to the what we were saying previously, a couple of things came to mind. Also about what it means to grapple with the academy as a site of struggle, a site of violence, but also as a site of struggle. And I think we're seeing that so profoundly in this moment where our university endowments are invested in the corporations that are producing the bombs that are raining down over Gaza, where we're seeing student activists and scholars of Palestine who are being censured and silenced and are facing job insecurity. And so what it really means to think about, I think part of why my answer to the previous question was so equivocal is because in this moment, it's so hard to really understand what the academy is in this moment, if not as a deeply conservative force and a site of violence. And I think another way to think about it is, how do we understand the academy as a site of struggle? Do we think about the importance of our role as scholars, also as facilitators of study and facilitators of political education, right? Thinking about all of the amazing teach-ins that are being organized in this moment by faculty who are facing reprisal. And also, how do we, in the spirit of the undercommons, how do we strategically pilfer from the institution and repurpose those resources to accomplish things that maybe the university might have never expected? Right? And how do we always ensure, without reproducing a kind of facile sort of binary between university and community, right? But how do we always ensure that those boundaries remain porous? And to go back to the question of Agamben, right? I think Agamben having this really nuanced critique of citizenship and then saying, I don't believe in you solely, is like a great example of the kind of the worst kind of abstract armchair theorization that unfolds in a way that's completely disconnected from politics on the ground, right? That's the only way that someone could have that a thorough critique of citizenship and then come out on the other end and say, no, it's really not that important, right? Because, and actually maybe this leads me into your question about citizenship and the politics of the human, right? That precisely why citizenship matters is because it is a site of violence and dehumanization. And that has often felt like, for me, a sort of gap or this open question in kind of critical citizenship studies literature, which has done this really powerful job of showing that citizenship is a site of violence. It is a site through which racisms get reproduced. But there's always still that question of then what do we do? What do we do with citizenship? And I think it's an abolitionist question, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that, and actually for my next book, I've been thinking more about what it means to bring abolitionist analysis to the question of citizenship. And in the same way that I have not spoken to a single abolitionist scholar or activist who believes that we can disappear police and prison overnight. This is where we get the famous critical resistance chart of reformist reforms versus abolitionist reforms, right? So what are the steps that actually move us in the direction of decreasing the amount of state resources that go toward carcerality and sending resources to life-affirming institutions? I think there's a similar kind of question to be asked about citizenship, because in this moment, for so many people around the world who are denied citizenship, this is not just a kind of abstract intellectual thing, The lack of citizenship has deeply meaningful consequences on an emotional level, but also at a material level in terms of the ability to live one's life without fear of deportation, the ability to have jobs, the ability to travel, to reunify with family, to pursue educational opportunities. And so to deny the significance of that is intellectual hubris of the sort of the worst sort. And at the same time, we have to be critical of the way that advocacy that is simply focused on the expansion of citizenship rights without questioning the apparatus of citizenship itself can lead to all sorts of unintended consequences. And I talk about that in my book, right? The sort of further marginalization of refugees as these unassimilable subjects. Or even in the United States, there's a piece that I often teach by the poet and activist Alan Pelaez Lopez, who for many years had been involved in the Dream movement. And Alan Pelaez Lopez in that piece talks about their discomfort with discourses of economic productivity and law abidingness that go hand in hand with advocacy for the expansion of citizenship to children who were brought to the US as undocumented youth, right? We work hard, we go to school, we don't break the law. But what does that imply? It implies that there are other people who are not hardworking, who are not contributing to the economy, who therefore should be further pushed outside the realm of citizenship. It also reinforces the idea that certain groups have to justify their belonging through certain kinds of economic productivity. So the question is, how do we both, actually my comrade, a Black Italian scholar named Magda Gebremariam Tesfal put it this way. She said, how do we both mobilize so that everyone has citizenship and also work toward a world where citizenship doesn't matter anymore? And I think that's the fundamental question. And again, it's a question that could be dismissed as totally unrealistic in the same way that abolitionists are often dismissed as being unrealistic for imagining a world without police and prisons. But what does it mean to actually imagine a world where citizenship does not determine your life chances, your life opportunities, your access to resources, your access to mobility?
I think discourses oriented around citizenship, particularly in settler colonial states, also have the effect of solidifying settler sovereignty and the sovereign's right to determine who belongs inside versus outside the polity in ways that continue to be predicated on anti-Indigenous dispossession and genocide, which again speaks to the point that you made earlier about the importance of connecting Black and Indigenous geographies. We also see the connection of Black geographies with other anti-colonial geographies in, for example, the case that's been brought by South Africa to the International Court of Justice on the Gaza genocide, echoing long traditions of anti-Blackness in international law. Critics have represented this as an African abuse or misunderstanding of legal process, as if it is not those who have suffered apartheid and genocide themselves who have the greatest understanding of what these terms mean legally and morally. Also represented as an insidious and inappropriate act of South Africans interfering where they don't belong, as if there are not these long histories of Black, African, Palestinian solidarity in ways that far exceed the colonial geographies that make legible with certain relationships and mobilities. So can you talk a bit about what are some of the other geographies that Black geographies are in relationship with in thinking towards a decolonized world?
I would just want to add that what the other salvo is to criminalize the litigant, right? So you're representing Hamas. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, this turning this upside down.
Yeah. So it's coming from, because I see my two subfields as Black geographies and Black European studies. And Black European studies actually has so much to offer this moment in terms of how we are thinking about questions of solidarity, how we are thinking about genocide. And one thing that has stood out to me, and the genocide in Gaza broke out as I was teaching my migrant Europe class at UC Santa Cruz. And so much of what we do in that class before we even talk about post-World War II, post-colonial migrations to Europe, is to lay a theoretical foundation for how race is talked or not talked about in Europe today, because there is still this resounding silence around race, France perhaps being the most obvious example of a sort of liberal colorblindness that says, but there is no race. Race has nothing to do here. It's all liberté, égalité, fraternité. And part of that is connected to this sort of post-World War II move to exceptionalize the Holocaust as the epitome of European racism that was unprecedented, but then with the defeat of fascism was eradicated. So we saw the dangers of race in that moment. We overcame it. Now we're not going to talk about race because to do so could be to open the doors to fascism once again. And of course, there are lots of analytical, but also historical errors in that. And one of the problems with this sort of exceptionalization of the Holocaust in a way that frankly also ignores the extermination of the Roma as well. It ignores the extermination of Black people, of disabled people, of many others who were also victims of that genocide. But it also ignores the colonial violence that predated the Holocaust, but also set the intellectual, political, logistical, theoretical foundations for what was carried out, during World War II. So why is it that we don't talk about the Herero and Nama genocide? Why is it that we are also not talking about the Armenian genocide? And when we talk about the Herero and Nama genocide, historians have shown that there is a direct bright line in terms of the discourses of dehumanization, the strategies, right? Concentration camps, medical experimentation, but also the individuals who oversaw that genocide, who then trained Nazi doctors and administrators, right? This is the argument that Amy Césaire makes in the Discourse on Colonialism, right? That Europeans only started to care about racial violence when that violence was no longer solely being enacted against people in the colonies, but it was turned inward to populations within Europe. And so I think so much of this sort of hand-wringing about the application of the language of genocide to what's happening in Palestine is part of this sort of longer process that has invisibilized Yeah, absolutely. And again, there's a funny way as well that Italy gets erased from that history, right? The significance of Italian fascism, but also the significance of Italian racial theorization that predated the rise of fascism in the sort of international circulation of eugenics theories. Italy was right there too. We don't really talk about that enough. But to your question about the relationality of Black geographies, again, in this seminar that I gave for a group in Italy, I actually used Du Bois in Dusk of Dawn as a way to think about Black and Palestinian solidarity in this moment. And that has been an important theoretical touchstone for me as well, thinking about Du Bois. He lived almost 100 years. And so he had this vantage point where he saw all of these shifts in the way that race was understood over the course of his lifetime. He saw a genealogy of racial theory and racial understandings unfolding over his life. And then through his travels through Europe and his involvement with Pan-Africanism and his involvement with other sorts of anti-colonial movements, all of these things transformed his understanding of Blackness over the course of his life. Whereas when does he write The Conservation of Races? So this is in the wake of his studies in Germany, where he's exposed to sort of neo-Hegelian philosophy and this notion of world history as the history of the superior races. And he writes this statement that is really about trying to insert Black Americans into sort of the world history of the great races. By the end of his life, his sort of understanding of Blackness really shifts, where he says he looks back at his own family genealogy. He thinks about all of these different moments of racial recognition and misrecognition, whether it's at Fisk or whether it's at the University of Berlin. And he says, my Blackness is not about biological kinship, and it's really not about phenotype. And it's not even necessarily about, but Blackness and this, what is Africa to me, right? This sense of a connection, this affective tie to Africa is actually about a shared history of struggle. He says, what connects me to Africa and people of the African diaspora is really about this shared history of slavery, discrimination, and insult. And then from there, he says, and that necessarily means that this is a history that is also shared basically across all colonized people, right? He talks about indigenous populations. He talks about colonized people in South Asia. And so I think that is one vision of when we begin to move away from a biocentric understanding of Blackness. And as Catherine McKittrick reminds us, there's all these subtle ways that we still often, without really realizing it, hold on to a biocentric understanding of Blackness as rooted in descent. When we begin to think about Blackness as a set of shared connections that come through shared history, and also shared struggle, then that necessarily means that our fate as Black people is tied to the fate of all oppressed and marginalized people around the world. And therefore, why I understand myself as having a moral, ethical, political obligation that stems from my Blackness to also advocate and mobilize for the liberation of Palestinians in the spirit of Angela Davis and June Jordan and Stuart Hall, MLK, Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, so many others, right? And I think that's how I understand Blackness, right? Not in its, and Cedric Robinson also makes this point as well. He has this really interesting reflection. It's in the introduction of Futures of Black Radicalism, which was an unfinished essay that he wrote, where he also thinks about the connection between the Black diaspora and the Irish based on shared histories of colonization. Right? Which often sits uncomfortably because we're so used to a kind of white supremacist grievance narrative of white slavery. But that's not what he's doing. He's actually trying to activate these shared histories of struggle to articulate political solidarities in a way that I think is really powerful.
I was just going to say that perhaps in understanding these connections, this also speaks to the importance of centering the Black Mediterranean, where historically mm-hmm. so many of these connections have been made so salient and visible, even in the very person of someone like Christopher Columbus, who had his experience in the trade of enslaved Black people before he went on to conquer the so-called New World, inaugurating the genocide there, leaving from a port in Spain, which is the very port from which Jews were being expelled from Spain following the Spanish Christian conquest and Inquisition against the Jews and the Muslims there. And so speaking very strongly to these co-constitutive forces of anti-Blackness, anti-Indigenous genocide, anti-Muslim and anti-Jewish demonization and expulsion yeah. that have been foundational in forming this picture of quote-unquote white Europe that underpins so many of the geographies of violence that yeah. you deconstruct.
Absolutely. The Mediterranean of the late 15th century is where we begin to see the emergence of Stuart Hall writes about this in Formations of Modernity. This is where we begin to see the consolidation of Europe as a category that is understood to have a shared racial, cultural, civilizational history. And that happens through these first voyages of conquest and indigenous dispossession. It happens through the Inquisition and the forcible conversion of Jews. It happens through the expulsion of the Moors. This is why David Thiel Goldberg talks about effectively the Muslim, the Jew, and the Black as the three figures against which a kind of European whiteness is forged. And the Mediterranean is really where that starts. So thank you for raising that question, because this is also something that on a theoretical level has been really important for me in terms of thinking about these geographies of Blackness and geographies of racial capitalism, which is to say, we know about the importance of the Atlantic, right, in the formation of this modern world, but we actually talk a lot less than we should about the centrality of the Mediterranean. Cedric Robinson, again, I teach Black Marxism a lot, so I'm always going back to it, but when Cedric Robinson is constructing this history of racial capitalism, where does he start? He starts in the Mediterranean too. So what does it mean when we reorient the way we understand the history of racial capitalism in a way that takes seriously the Mediterranean as this historical, but also ongoing site of struggle? So when we also think about how these struggles are interrelated in the present, something that, again, I've learned from doing this research is that I think whereas in the US, there is not always, but sometimes a tendency, even in the way that we, not just our political struggles, but we think about how our departments and disciplines are organized, where we have indigenous struggles and then Black struggles, and then, for example, immigrant struggles, and those sort of get mapped onto different communities and different kinds of places and different politics. It's so much harder to disaggregate those things in the Mediterranean because we're seeing coloniality and border fortification and anti-Blackness colliding in ways that also alerts us to the fact that they are always intertwined in the US context as well, and that we would do well to pay better attention to how all of these struggles are connected here rather than disaggregating them in the way that I think the sort of disciplinary divide and conquer strategy has trained us to do for so long.
One thing I would just add to what you said is that your work does such a wonderful job of helping us see the imprint of those struggles in space. We can view how different players, different subjects have made those kinds of struggles evident in the way they carry out their lives, either in very dramatic or in very microscopic ways, in which we can understand as we look around the city and nation space and the local neighborhoods even. That might be the note to end on. Aziza, did you have any other thoughts or things to say?
We could probably just talk on and off.
Probably.
Maybe we could leave it here for now, yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Camille. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
Please take a moment to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. This will help bring it to other people's attentions. You might also follow me on Twitter at Palumbo Liu and let us know about any subjects you would like us to cover or people or groups you'd like us to interview.